Welcome back, folks. We're talking with Ralph Ellis about his new book, Jesus, King of Odessa, and we're carrying on our conversation here, continuing the story as it's unfolding. Very interesting. And there's one point we wanted to go back to, Ralph, earlier. We were talking about the Omphalos Stone, and you reminded me to go back there and finish up on that point. So let's begin there.
Yeah, the Omphalos Stone. I'm beginning to think that the Omphalos is more central to this religion than almost anything else. It just keeps cropping up every time I start doing something. This sort of magical meteorite keeps coming into the conversation. And lo and behold, it came into Odessa as well, which I was quite surprised about, actually. I mean, we know that it was connected with Greece, of course, with the Omphalos of Delphi. It was connected with Egypt, the Ben Stone of Egypt, of course. So it's connected with Islam as well, the sacred stone that they have in Mecca, in the Kaaba, which is supposed to be of the same stone, actually. But there we go. We're not sure about that.
Meteorite, some black stone.
Supposed to be a meteorite, yeah. Black stone, supposed to be a meteorite. Why this particular meteorite was supposed to be so special, I don't know. The rumor, historical rumor, is that it was magnetic. And of course, if you had a big magnetic, a very strong magnetic stone in that era, it would have looked pretty peculiar. This is a stone that would have attracted your sword. So if you approached it with a sword, the stone would steal your sword. It would take it off you. The hand of God had just ripped the sword out of your hand. That's what people would think, wouldn't they? You know, this invisible force had just grabbed their sword. Jeez, what did that happen, you know?
Yeah, something supernatural.
Very supernatural. If you'd never come across magnetism before, you would be quite astounded that a completely invisible force has just taken your sword from you. That would be pretty magical, wouldn't it?
Sorry to interrupt, Ralph. I just wanted to ask you more about that. Have you heard about someone who's actually done a more in-depth, thorough study of the stone in the Kaaba, what it actually is, or do they not allow anybody to get closer to it than looking?
Well, no. I don't think anyone has. I've not gone out of my way to investigate it too much because it's a bit off my radar. But you can't go to Kaaba, of course. If you are a Christian, you're not even allowed into Mecca. That's just if you go down the motorway from Ridda towards Mecca, it has a big sign saying, "Non-Muslims, get off. You're not allowed into Mecca." That's how Islam operates. There is no equanimity between religions within Islam. So if you're a Muslim, you can go to Canterbury Cathedral, but as a Christian, if you went to Mecca, you would be torn apart by the mob, basically. So it rather limits investigations as to what the Meccan stone is all about. My guess is it's probably a fake. I don't know, but it doesn't seem very special to me, the stones that they have. One of the stones is supposed to be above a mosque in Istanbul, which I went to have a look at. And that didn't seem to be overly special either. It just looked like a piece of black basalt or something. It didn't look, you know, one imagines a meteorite will probably be metallic or something.
Yeah.
Most meteorites are fairly specialized stones. But this looked like a lump of basalt, so I don't think they've got the original. But we have a good idea that the original might be something special, might be metallic, might be magnetic, because one of the special stones, of course, is the Holy Grail. So if you read Arthurian legend, and this is where I start blending, you know, Jesus being in Chester and Jesus being the foundation of Arthurian legend and so on. And then, of course, the Arthurian legend is looking for the Holy Grail. And one of the manifestations of the Holy Grail is a stone. It is described as a stone with letters on it that has magical properties. And, of course, all of the attendants of the stone are not allowed to use metal tools or swords. They have to use non-metallic ones, silver ones, which sort of gives a hint about something. There might be something to do with magnetism here.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have the story of the sword in the stone. And what is the story of, you know, the sword in the stone? It's a sword that got stuck in a stone, and only King Arthur could withdraw the stone, the sword from the stone. Is that not magnetism? Isn't that what this story is about? You could quite easily imagine that Arthur was the only person who could take his sword off the stone easily, because he knew this was magnetism, and he was using a bronze sword instead of an iron sword. And of course, bronze will not be attracted to a magnet. Mm. So he could demonstrate how clever he was by being the only person who could put his sword onto the stone, and they couldn't.
Or if the king was the only one to approach the stone or could handle it in some way, then he would be the only one who could do that.
So, we have these hints that this sacred stone might have been magnetic. But it has a very long history. It comes out of Egypt. It's central to Greek religion, of course. We have lots of images of it. That's the advantage, of course, of the Greek history, is we have lots of images of this particular Omphalos stone. And it's a sort of domed, not pyramid. It's more domed than that. It's a sort of how would you describe it? Triangular? No. Anyway, it's a domed stone.
Yeah.
Probably about a meter high maximum. No, probably less than that actually. Probably only about 70 centimeters high. So it's fairly smallish. And in the coins of Greece, you often have Apollo sitting on the top of it, using it as a stool, sitting on the top of it, and it's covered in netting.
Yeah.
And of course, this netting it looks like something that's plaited, of course. And so what we get with the Omphalos stone is a domed stone with netting around it that looks like it's plaited.
It kind of looks like a beehive a little bit.
Yeah. So one of the old style skip beehives. Yes, one of the domed. Yeah, it does look a lot like that. But of course, if you look at the crown of the Edessan monarchy, of course, is exactly the same. It's domed and it has netting all round the sides of it. So this is the reason that I've associated this crown with the Omphalos stone, as well as the fact that the Edessans also venerated this particular stone. So we're beginning to put together a sort of travelogue, a history of this particular stone. And it came out of Egypt. It comes through Judaism, and we know let's say it went through Judaism first. So it was in Egypt. Judaism began in Egypt, of course. This is where the Israelites were, and of course, if you've read my other books, then they say that the Israelites were Egyptians anyway. So it went through Judaism, and we know it went through Judaism because the holy day of the Jewish religion is Yom Kippur, which means the Day of the Stone. Okay, they say it means the Day of Atonement, but Kippur is actually derived from a word that means stone. So it actually means the Day of the Stone. And you can imagine that that is exactly what it was, because originally, if they had venerated the Omphalos stone, then their holy day would have been a celebration of that particular stone. It would have been Yom Kippur, the Day of the Stone. And also, the most holy relic within Judaism was a box containing two stones, which we call the Ark of the Covenant. And I'll come back to the Ark later, because I've discovered the Ark as well. Well, sort of discovered where it was anyway.
Okay. That's exciting.
Yeah. Gets, something to hang on to for the rest of the interview. Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah.
And then the stone goes off. It gets exiled. And there are various exiles we've had from Egypt. We know about the exoduses from Egypt. There are several of them. One was the great exodus of the Hyksos, which I link with the Israelite exodus. That was about 1600 BC. Then we have the minor exodus of the maimed priests and lepers. That was the exodus of Pharaoh Akhenaten. And all of these people were pushed out into various other locations. One of the locations they went to, quite obviously, was Greece. And I think it's from that we suddenly have this stone arriving in Delphi and being that one of the central cult objects of Greek religion. I think it's the same stone. And then, of course, we have Alexander the Great, and he zooms off across Turkey, across Iraq, across Iran, into India. And all of the East becomes Greek. And, of course, this image of the Omphalos stone is now a Parthian image, a Persian image. And you have to wonder, in that case, is this just imagery? They're just using it as a symbol on the back of their coins. Or was it there? Was it now in Persia? I think possibly it was, because my idea on this is that out of Persia, eventually in AD 4, we have another exile, and that's the exile of dear old Quinthia Musa Urania.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The Greco-Egyptian princess who became a queen of Persia and was kicked out in AD 4. And she comes eastwards, and it is she who founds Edessa as a capital city. And it happens that in Edessa, they also had an Omphalos stone. And this is a strange part. I've not really worked out this part of Edessan history because it's very confusing, and it's something for the future. But the Edessans made a necropolis, a city of the dead. But this is a royal necropolis. This is not for the people. The necropolis for the people is further south. I forget what its name's called. And then you've got this hill that's just littered with grave. Not exactly tombs, but these are the places where, you know, where they put people while the body rots, and then they collect up the bones later and take the bones back home again. So they're not burial centers. It's not a tomb as such. This is where you left the dead to rot, and then you gathered their bones up. So the necropolis of the people is further south. This particular necropolis is slightly further north. It's at Sogmatar, which is just to the east of Edessa. And this royal necropolis has the same sort of tombs, circular, drum-like, stuck on the top of hills. There's about 10 of them, I think, something like that. But the central part of this necropolis is Silbury Hill. Silbury Hill from Wessex, or wherever it is. Is it Wessex? Yeah, I think it's Wessex. It's exactly the same. If you've been to Silbury Hill, then you'll know exactly what it looks like. It's exactly the same size. And it looks exactly the same, with a nice little flat top on it. And that's stuck in the middle of this necropolis. And that's peculiar in itself, because it's so similar to Silbury, you would have thought there was a link. But chronologically, there is not really a link between these two hills. This hill is supposed to be... well, some of them say Roman. I don't think it's Roman. I think it's probably maybe Iron Age. But Silbury Hill is supposed to be much older than that. But anyway, you have to wonder what the link is between Silbury Hill and this place way over in eastern Turkey. But anyway, on the top of this hill, there was an inscription, because there's a little building up there. There's it sort of looks like a fortress, but it's probably actually a temple. And there was an inscription on the top of this hill that said that the Ark of the Covenant had been put on the top of this hill, and it was looked after. The person who looked after the Ark of the Covenant was the Buddha, This was the priest called the Buddha. So we come across the Ark of the Covenant again, and it's not entirely clear if this was a new one or whether it was the original one. So, I mean, the Ark of the Covenant's only made of wood, so someone could have made a new one. But the fact that they had such an artifact there sort of indicates that the sacred stones they had there, the Omphalos stones, were closely linked with the stones that were in the original Ark of the Covenant. So, I mean, who knows? We don't know if this is the same stones. I rather think they are the same stones and not copies of the stones. But this same Judaic imagery was now present in Edessa, the Ark of the Covenant, and the sacred stones as well. And now you can begin to see, A, why the Edessans had the Omphalos stone as a crown, and B, why they were so important in Judean politics. These people weren't really Jewish. I mean, they were Egypto-Parthians, so they had the same heritage as the Jews. They come out of Egypt, part of the same royal family, but had been separated from the Jews for a long, long time. So their concept of Judaism was completely different now to what Orthodox Jews were thinking in Jerusalem. And so they would have probably thought that they were heretics. But if this king could come down to Jerusalem and said, well, you know, I've got the Ark of the Covenant back in my city and the sacred stones that went in the Ark as well. Well, you can imagine that would count for quite a lot in Judean terms. It would certainly make this royal family much more important in Judea. And I think that is basically what happened. Later on, because Edessa was taken over more by the Romans, and when we get to the 3rd century, so when Edessa was failing and being absorbed into the Roman Empire, we then have another emperor who I wrote about in the previous book in King Jesus. And this is the mad emperor Elagabalus. It's worth reading up on his history, actually, because he's quite a bizarre character. And he was an Assyrian king, so he came out of the same region. So he was Syrian, and he was the high priest of the Elagabal. And the Elagabal is the Omphalos stone. It's the same old stone again. And he was so in love with this particular religion and his wonderful stone that he took it to Rome and set it up in a temple in Rome. And it is from the Roman images of this stone that we have another good idea of what it looked like and what it was all about, what this idea of this stone was all about. Because the Roman images on their coins, on the coins of Elagabalus, are again the same as the Greek ones. So we have this domed stone, rounded at the top. And this time, instead of a net around the stone, we have the phoenix on it. So we have the image of the phoenix. And that's interesting because it gives us an idea about what this stone was all about. The phoenix was, of course, the bird that regenerated itself, and it regenerated itself every few thousand years. I think this was connected with the procession of the equinox. And of course, every 2,200 years, we get a new great month. So we get a new regeneration of a new great month when, you know, you turn from Aries, say, to Pisces.
Yeah.
And this is what the phoenix was doing. He was regenerating himself in the same fashion. But he was doing it as a flaming fire. And you can imagine that if this stone was a meteorite, then that's exactly what happened when this meteorite arrived, of course. It arrived on Earth as a flaming fire, as a phoenix. And so you can see how the link between the phoenix and the stone was probably generated. And it has lots of other connections as well, because a phoenix in Greek is a palm tree. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. A phoenix is a palm tree. And so when we come to places like the city of Palmyra, the city of palms, which I say was actually created by the Edessan monarchy, this is the city out in eastern Syria. You can say it's Palmyra, the city of palms, but you can also say it's the city of the phoenix. So it's exactly the same as Phoenix in Arizona. It has the same name. Palmyra is Phoenix.
Hmm.
So there are lots of links and parallels with Phoenix imagery as well.
I wanted to ask you, if I don't jump ahead of myself here, Ralph, or back up actually more, but with a stone, you know, falling or something falling from the skies kind of thing, you have a little section on Lucifer in there as well. Is there any connection to this in between here?
Well, there you are. There's so many connections can be made. No, I've not made that particular connection. You've just done it. So you're going to have to write a book about this, you know.
Oh, no. No.
This is your next task.
Okay, next month I'll get cracking on it. Promise.
That is another possibility. I've actually said that Lucifer, because Lucifer is the falling star, of course. Lucifer is linked to Venus because Venus is the morning star. But Lucifer, in Old Testament terms, was King Nabonus, I think. You might have to correct me on that pronunciation. But anyway, he was two kings after Nebuchadnezzar. And he was the king who was lost the battle to Cyrus the Great. And this is why he was known as Lucifer, the fallen king, the fallen star. And he was celebrated as such. This was a great time of joy, of course, for the Jews, because Nebuchadnezzar had taken the Jews into the Babylonian exile. And it was this next king who was defeated by Cyrus the Great, who defeated him, who released the Jews from bondage. And so they celebrated this king who had just lost this battle as Lucifer, the fallen star, the fallen king. So that's what Lucifer was originally. So it had nothing to do with devils and all this sort of business they keep on about.
Yeah.
It was really to do with this Babylonian king who lost this battle and freed the Jews from Babylonian bondage. Yeah. But yes, could he be linked with the phoenix? Well, yes, of course he could, because all of these things are end of a particular era and the beginning of a new particular era. And of course, that's what the phoenix was all about, the end of one era and the beginning of new era. So yes, can you link Lucifer and the phoenix? I'm sure you probably could somehow, but it needs somebody to have a look at that in more detail. Yeah, interesting.
So the phoenix here as a symbol of change, is this then indicative of a change happening in this time period that we've been talking about? This is where the shift happens from one celestial month to another.
Yes, yeah, this was indeed. This was the great change in the great month from the month of Aries into the month of Pisces. So, yeah, this is why Jesus was born as a Lamb of God but became a fisher of men. He went from Aries to Pisces. So we had a change in the great month at this very, very moment. And so this was a phoenix moment, as it were. You know, this was the phoenix regenerating itself. So it's not surprising that the kings of Edessa would have been closely linked with the phoenix and then with the Omphalos stone, if the Omphalos stone was a symbol of the phoenix, which I think it was. So it all sort of comes together, all this symbology. You can imagine why this was a very special era, because, yeah, people did think it was the end of the world. You know, it was the end of one era and the beginning of a new era. And he actually mentions this in the New Testament when, I forget what Jesus was talking about at the time, but he was talking about this will be the end of the world. But in the Greek, that's not what he said. He said it would be the end of an eon, which is an end of an era. Well, yes, it was. It was the end of Aries and the beginning of Pisces. So all of this talk about the end of times was actually a discussion about astrology. It was nothing to do with the world blowing up. It was all astrology. And that was the basis, of course, of their religion. You know, the Nazarene religion was all about astrology. And the stone was linked into that astrology because it was a meteorite that came out of the celestial sphere above us.
And
all of the characters were associated with that. You know, so Mary was the sea star. She was the Stella Maris. And the great heavens above were the great seas of the stars. And this comes out of Egyptian religion, of course, because, you know, Ra sailed across the skies on a solar boat. So the skies were a sea. It was a celestial sea. And this is why Mary was the Stella Maris, the sea star. So it's all interlinked, all of it. It's all very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the, you know, the Omphalos, the further the connections with the possible, you know, head regalia, headgear here. You have some interesting connections in the book about, well, both the shape that we've seen of these interesting skulls of, you know, Tutankhamun and other in Egypt, and there goes further into the you know, the white and the red crown, how that looks. Even when you talked about the Omphalos stone earlier, I looked at the coins of it. Even to a certain degree, the Pope hat has very much the same you know, kind of shape to it. So are we talking about one universal crown to kind of symbolically give the idea that this is the Christ, the king, whoever wears this shape on his head?
Yes, it does seem to have been important. Strangely enough, you bring this up, it was only a piece I tacked on at the very end of the book because it wasn't central to this thesis. And I suddenly thought, hey, hold on, I remember that shape before. This domed crown, if you look at this domed crown, especially is on the head of the king on the coins, it looks like a cone head. And I think everyone who's watched the children's television will know what a cone head looks like. Yes, it looks like these cone heads that you get in Central America, of course, if you want to read some of David Hatcher Childress's books about Central America. It was very prevalent in Central America, the reshaping of children's heads so they formed a cone head. And they did it, it's not so widely known, they did it in Egypt as well. So all of the Amarna royals were all cone heads. So King Tutankhamun, all of the princesses of the Amarna family, they were all cone heads. And we can see this very clearly in the sculptures they made of this particular family. And these cone heads, and Nefertiti as well, she was a cone head as well. And these cone heads look very much like the Edessan royals. And actually, I say these two royal families are actually closely linked. So, you know, the Edessan royalty would have been descended from Akhenaten anyway. So the question then becomes is, was this crown an imitation of previous crowns to make people look like a cone head? Or was Jesus actually a cone head himself?
Yeah.
In the same fashion as the Amarna royal family, the family of Pharaoh Akhenaten. It's quite possible that he was a cone head as well. You would never know it underneath the crown because it would all be covered up, exactly the same as you wouldn't know that Nefertiti was a cone head because she always wore a crown. But if you look at the shape of some of the crowns she wore, they are exactly the same shape as her daughters, and they have cone heads. So, you know, it's quite obvious that Nefertiti was just covering up the fact that she was a cone head by having a large hat on, which covered it up.
What is this indicative of? Is it simply manipulation of the skull in the early years, or is there something else to this? What do you make of it?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, did they always do this by skull shaping? Because we know you can do it by skull shaping if you bind an infant's head. But some of the results I've seen from Africa are not particularly successful. It doesn't look very conish, really.
It gets flat, kind of in the back.
Yeah, and, that's right.
I
thought it wasn't very convincing either, some of these recent ones. Or were they genetically coneheads? But if they were genetically coneheads, then where are the modern genetic coneheads? Because we know the Odessa family didn't die out. And I very much doubt if the Akhenaten family died out. He would have had too many children for it just to completely die out. And, you know, I've traced the remnants of this family all around, all the way as far as Scotland and Ireland and so on. And we don't actually see coneheads in the modern population. So I'm inclined to think it was shaping of infants, but they must have been very skillful at doing it if the depictions are correct, because they're quite good coneheads they made.
So that in turn could have been a kind of a veneration for the Umfala stone or something like that they wanted to, you know, shape the head of the king into that, you know, shape pretty much that structure. I don't know. What do you think? Why would they do?
If you want me to speculate further, I would say it's the shape of the heads of the gods.
Okay. Yeah.
So that Akhenaten knew that the shape, the form, the physiology of what the gods look like, and wanted to shape his body in the same fashion. And so we have, you know, Akhenaten shaped with a very sort of triangular looking head. He's got, you know, a very thin chin, a very wide forehead with his, possibly with a cone head on the top. We can't tell because he's normally got a hat on. With his very half effeminate body with no genitalia. So he's completely, I wouldn't say just castrated. He's almost a hermaphrodite in his physiology. And of course, this links up to Odessa again, because the chief character that the Odessans venerated within Nazarene religion was the primeval Adam. And the primeval Adam was a hermaphrodite. And of course, if you go back to one of my books that I wrote years and years and years ago, again, this all starts linking up. I said that Adam was Pharaoh Akhenaten. So that, if you remember from Eden in Egypt, it was called, I said that Adam and Eve were Akhenaten and Nefertiti. Because the Genesis story, as we know it, was not a story about the creation of the world. It was a story about the dawning of a new day. It was the hymn to the Aten. If you compare the hymn to the Aten to the Genesis story, they are remarkably similar. And what's happened here is someone has had this story before them, didn't quite understand it, thought it sort of looked like a creation myth, and so they stuck it at the beginning of the Bible. But it shouldn't have been at the beginning of the Bible at all. It was nothing to do with the creation myth. It was the hymn to the Aten. It was the celebration of a dawning of a new day, with, you know, the sun rising over the horizon and the rays of the sun warming the world, and all the birds stretching their wings and the animals stretching their legs and coming to life again at the beginning of a new day. That was what the story was originally about. And the hero of that story was Adam and Eve, and they were Akhenaten and Nefertiti. This is why Adam and Eve are always portrayed as being naked within the Garden of Eden, because Akhenaten and Nefertiti were always naked, and they lived in the Garden of Aten, the Garden of Eden. So it all matches up. And then, of course, we find, of course, that Pharaoh Akhenaten was a hermaphrodite. Well, he wasn't really, but that's how he portrayed himself anyway. And the hero of the Odessan monarchy was the primeval Adam. And the primeval Adam was a hermaphrodite. He was Akhenaten. So the hero of Odessan religion was Pharaoh Akhenaten. Interesting. Very interesting. Especially when we know that the Amarna family of Akhenaten were all cone heads. And now we have the Edessan monarchy wearing a cone on their head.
And we're talking, a couple of thousand years in between here?
Nearly. 1,300. Well, yeah, okay. Just over 1,300, 1,400.
So potentially a long tradition here, a religion very keeps long. Going.
And kept alive by someone for a long, long time. You know, this tradition has been kept alive during various exoduses, because remember, the Amarna family was destroyed, or rather, I say, they were exiled. So wherever they were exiled to, the people managed to maintain that tradition all the way through, and then climb their way back up the greasy pole of royalty and ambition to get back to the top again as well. You know, they were toppled, they were thrown out of power, but they managed to crawl back to being monarchs again. It's quite clever, really. Mm. But, of course, if they had a magical stone with them, that might be one way you could claw your way back to power, because you could always amaze the proletariat. You always had something in your arsenal to say, look, I'm more powerful than you. I've got this magic stone. Could be one reason that they managed to get back into power again. It is an interesting story. And it all begins to match up. You know, I was writing Eden in Egypt. I was writing back in the early years of the 21st century, so about 10 years ago or so. Had no idea about Edessa at that time and how it would match up eventually with Edessa in the future. But it does. This is why I think I've tapped into a true vein of history, because this wouldn't happen if I was just plucking little bits out of history. It wouldn't all match up so nicely and easily, but it does.
Well, let me ask a little bit there when we're on that then, how some of the work have been received by some of the academics out there. It's, as always, as we know, at least on this program, we're talking a lot with people who either they don't care at all about academia, or if they're trying to get in there in some way, it's always proven difficult because we like to highlight alternative theories. So how's your journey on this been so far, Ralph?
It's been a rocky one, I would say, a very rocky one. I've experienced this before when I was talking about Solomon and various other things, you know, being a pharaoh of Egypt, and I clashed with various people in academia. And I've just done so again over this Edessa book. Someone picked it up in academia and wrote a review of it and completely trashed it and said it was a load of rubbish and had all of these points. It was wrong, 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 wrong. Everything was wrong. And I started to read this review, and the guy had never even read the book. Half of the points he was saying are wrong were not even in the book in the first place. So
well,
he was like,
he's already convinced it's wrong, so he doesn't have to read it, see?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's wrong just by the cover of the jacket, you know.
That's right.
He actually said that. He said the jacket is wrong, therefore the book's wrong. but, yes, he hadn't had the common decency to even read the book, so he had only reviewed the book off a couple of comments on the net, probably one or two of the advertising comments I had made about it. And he had made a complete review of the book from there. But he had actually invented parts of the book that don't exist. So he was talking about how can Ellis talk about Abgar the 6th and 7th and 8th doing this and that. They were not even... I don't even mention those kings. They're the subsequent kings that you were talking about earlier that we must research later on, because that's an interesting side of the Edessan story. That's the story of Edessa after Jesus, after the Jewish revolt, the continuation of the royal line of Edessa, which continued all the way up to the 3rd century AD. Interesting story, but I don't mention it. I didn't have time, and the book's big enough anyway. I've got 600 pages, you know. How big can you get? He's making a review of a book that I didn't even write. I was a bit incensed about that, especially as it became one of the leading topics on the net. So I sort of challenged this guy, and we've had a bit of a ding-dong battle over this. And It's funny. Firstly, he's so full of himself that he's correct in everything he says. Secondly, all of his colleagues seem to join in, even though they don't know anything about the topic whatsoever. They join in and say, yes, yes, that's rubbish, when they haven't read the book either, and they've probably not even read the notes on the net. But it's still rubbish, even though they don't know anything about it. And then they have this pure arrogance that they have a PhD or whatever they've got, and they know about history, and therefore you're wrong. And they've never thought that, hold on, that guy has just been researching this particular topic for 25 years. Perhaps he might know a thing or two about it. But no, they don't think that. They just charge in like bulls and saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But they're saying this is wrong just from maybe something they've read 10 years ago, maybe something they've remembered. They're not actually researching this. They're just making bland assumptions about it. And of course, they get caught out because I can quote chapter and verse backing up everything I say. Because everything I say, whether you believe it or not, whether you think my conclusions are correct or not, everything is there in the historical record. The works of, you know, Josephus and Moses of Corinth, John the historian, the Syriac historians, it's all in the various historical records. And they don't realize this. So I can quote chapter and verse to prove that everything they've said is utterly wrong. And then, of course, they get upset. And what they actually did is the two people I was debating with just deleted all of my comments completely. They could not stand being beaten at their own game and being shown up, effectively, because I showed them up that they didn't know what they were talking about. So they just deleted all the comments and then hid behind a great wall of censorship. And I find that very strange in the world of academia, that is how academia works in this day and age. And hurling abuse and invective from behind their wall of censorship, that they won't allow anyone to discuss a topic. They won't allow anyone to have a different viewpoint from the current historical viewpoint.
Yeah.
And they'll just delete you and mock you, even though everything they say is actually wrong. I don't mean I'm correct. I cannot say I'm correct. But what I've written is all backed up in the historical record. So whether you believe that I've actually made the right deductions from that evidence, the evidence itself is concrete. It's all come from the historical record. But you're not allowed to think that, according to these particular historians. You can only stay within the, you know, the established guidelines that they have for history.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
Anything that goes beyond it. Well, I can imagine that for, you know, a theologian. A theologian only has one doctrine to peddle. You know, they can't go out on a limb and say Jesus was something completely different because that's outside their doctrine.
Mm.
So they're locked into it, you know. They can't go anywhere else. But history should not be like that. But it operates in the same fashion as all the major religions. They operate,
certainly, of course.
Yeah, as if they have a fixed creed and they're not allowed to go outside it, and they will not go outside it.
It's a belief system like everything else, because we don't have all the data. We don't know. We're trying to figure it out, piece it together as we go, and as more things are discovered that are contradictory, we need to update, revise, and constantly, you know, revisit what we know to learn more. This is how things function. But
yes.
I mean, history, all of this is a very, very locked in subject that is very, very touchy. And as we know as well, Ralph, the victors write the history, right? So,
of course, yeah.
You know,
and in some senses, they are the victors, as it were, because these people in academia have created a power base from which they operate within.
Yeah.
So they have this big power base. It's funded by the government. And to maintain this power base, they maintain the fixed structures that they have within their understanding of history.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody wants to rock that particular boat because they might lose their job.
Exactly. They lose their job, their tenure, whatever they have, you know, their comfy seat there. But at the same time, even worse, it might be used for cover-ups, propaganda purposes, things that, you know, go far outside of just for the sake of accuracy here.
Yes.
So this is how it works. This is how it's functioned the longest time. And
it's very powerful. I mean, just recently we had this within the climate debate. Now, I'm not in favor of this climate alarmism, which they have. I don't mind people if they believe it, but you should have the right not to believe it if you want. But we had a very well-respected naturalist called David Bellamy, who was the BBC's favorite. Everybody loved this guy. He had a wonderful delivery, and he was very sincere about his environmentalism. But then one day he said he didn't believe in global warming.
Uh-oh. That was it.
That was it. That was it. You never saw him again. He was off. And he's never worked for the BBC since.
Yeah.
And that's how it happens. That's how powerful they are. Because he, in some senses, was quite powerful. He was a well-known figure. He was on the television all the time. And suddenly, boom, off he went.
Yeah.
Never saw him again. That is how powerful these cabals work. And if you can do that within climate science, you can certainly do it within historical science. And this appears to be how they are still working within the historical sphere. You are not allowed to be a dissenting voice.
Well, even on the basis that if it's something that they would consider to be outrageous, a find that you've done, a discovery, something you found in the records, make some, you know, connected some dots here, have a different suggestion, they would just dismiss it just because of the, from their point of view, the ridiculousness of it, without even looking at it.
Yes. Also, I think it's a threat. I think they don't like this threat to their current understanding. You can imagine you've got chief professor. He's taught history, Judean history, religious history, for 20 years, 30 years. He's now got to stand up in front of his students and say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, everything I've taught you over the last 2 or 3 years has actually been completely wrong. So we're just going to start your course again from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
This is why quite often these theories must go through a new generation before they can regenerate themselves, because the old guard cannot admit that they were wrong. It's very difficult for them to admit. So you have to wait for the old guard to die out before the new acorn can blossom into a big oak tree. And I think that's part of the problem. It's pure human pride, I suppose, that you can't admit that everything you've taught, you know, everything you've said, everything you've thought for the last 30, 40 years has been wrong. So it is a big shock to their system, I think. But even so, the way they go about destroying other ideas is not very healthy.
No.
You know, why not keep that idea brewing somewhere on the back burner, and we'll leave that one for later, you know, when we've thought about it a bit more. But they don't seem to want to do that. They want to destroy it.
Well, a little more, you know, humility in all this. I mean, as far as I know, no one has a time machine so we can go back and know exactly what has happened to the T, you know. So how about just having an open mind here? History is a very, very tricky thing. And I mean, as you've found as well, Ralph, what one guy writes has to do with other reasons and propaganda purposes. And even because it's documented or written somewhere, that doesn't make it true either, you know.
Yes, and I couldn't another part of this discussion with all of these various academics, because there's been about a dozen of them, is how they are taking things so much at face value instead of thinking about how this was written, why this was written. I mean, I've read Josephus now for many years, and it's quite obvious that Josephus Flavius was not writing pure history. He was writing propaganda for the Romans.
Yeah.
Therefore, everything he has written has come through this prism of Roman propaganda, and you need to be able to look at it in those terms. And they're translating names, or this, you know, the linguistic and grammar and syntax you've changed from this Aramaic word into Greek word is not proper syntax. Sorry, that's not what Josephus was doing. Josephus was making jokes. If you look at his accounts, if you look at the Talmudic accounts, even if you look at some of the New Testament accounts, they were making in-jokes for the in-crowd, which is what Pesha was all about, because you didn't want the Romans to know what you were writing about, because you might be strung up on a cross or something.
I want you to pick up that thought. I just want to ask you, does, in any regard, was that something that Josephus was involved in, meaning he did that because he still had also part allegiance to the Jews at the time? What do you think?
No. Knowing Josephus, he did this because of his own ego. He knew things that other people did not. And it's very difficult to know something very basic, very fundamental, very important, and never tell anybody else. How do you do that for your whole life? Josephus wanted to boast that he knew the real history, but he couldn't write it because the Romans would be very upset, and the Romans were his paymaster.
But who was his audience then? Who was he writing for? Who knew this? What he knew?
Good question.
Is it for the future generations? Is it for...
Good question.
Yeah.
I've sat and wondered about this for many, many months. Primarily, he was doing it for himself. Yeah, because he's the biggest egotist the world has ever seen. So he was doing it for himself. However, there's no point doing it for yourself if nobody else knows about it.
No egotist likes that. They don't want others
precisely.
To get it.
Yep. Someone else has got to know about it. So either he had a higher degrees within his church. He had an in crowd. Because remember, the Church of Jesus was a Masonic church based on degrees of initiation. So Josephus, who was thrown out of this church effectively, would have been very familiar with this way of speaking on two levels and having initiates into the inner levels and the plebs who only knew the outside information, the muggles, as they call them, you know, from Harry Potter. So we have the muggles, the outsiders, and then we have the initiates, and they are given the true information, which is exactly what Jesus says in the New Testament. You can have a look at my books for that, where he gives several examples of that. So Josephus would have been very, very familiar with that system of initiation. So he could have had his own band of initiates who he was letting this information go to. But if so, they've been very, very quiet about it. Nobody has followed up on this in the last 2,000 years.
As far as you know.
As far as I know. Well, precisely. Who knows? But the other possibility is what you've just said, that maybe he was writing for the future. Maybe he couldn't tell this to anyone else. But he wanted the possibility that someone else could find that information in the future.
Well, and this is what I've been thinking about. Has it anything to do with the rabbinical scholars that are looking into a lot of this material at this time and historically and trying to figure out what happened, specifically the grudge between the Romans and the Jews and all the rebellion back and forth? And I don't know, it feels like, I mean, was he a double agent? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, well, yes. Well, in some senses he was, because if you want me to go out on a limb, and I'm not afraid of going out on limbs. I've been out on many in my time. One of the big limbs I go out on is that I say that Josephus wrote the Talmud as well. So, because remember, after the fall of Jerusalem, everything was destroyed. Judaism was destroyed. Nazarene Judaism, the Church of Jesus, was destroyed. The only man left standing was Josephus Flavius. And he had he had permission from Vespasian to do whatever he liked within Judea, as long as he stopped Judea from revolting against Rome again. So it was Saul Josephus who created Christianity, a follow-up on his simple Judaism that he'd been selling to the Gentiles ever since the early AD 50s he started. Mm-hmm. He started selling simple Judaism for the Gentiles. That's what he did when he went across the Mediterranean. And he built upon that and created what we today will call Christianity.
Yeah.
So he was the leader of Christianity. But also, Judaism was rudderless as well, because Judaism had been destroyed. And it was Josephus, I believe, who recreated Judaism in his own image, as it were. Because, again, Rome wanted a less fundamentalist, more Rome-friendly form of Orthodox Judaism. And so he created what we know today as Judaism today. Because modern Judaism is not the Judaism of the first century, of course. You know, in modern Judaism, there are no roast sacrifices. Where did they all go to? Well, Josephus didn't like them, of course. So he recreated Judaism in the fashion that he wanted.
Does this mean that the previous Egyptian traditions that was blended here between the different cultures, was that more incorporated? Was it less incorporated?
Less. Josephus had failed his initiation. So when he went to become an initiate into the Church of Jesus, the Nazarene Church, he basically failed. And they never trusted him. He never got beyond the first degree, as it were. So he didn't know anything about it. This is why you don't see a great deal of astrology within the Bible. There is astrology there, but I don't think actually that Josephus understood it very much. So anything that Josephus did was watering down the original Egyptian belief systems. So, yeah, the worship of the stone disappeared. Astrology disappeared from Judaism and from Christianity. All of these things sort of faded out. I think he was more interested in his own ego than maintaining these old traditions.
In your view, Ralph, do you think that he destroyed something that was more meaningful and simplified it and just watered it down a bit?
Yes, because the original religion, I think, was very, very interesting. It was Gnosis, which is where we get the Gnostics from. It was Gnosis, and Gnosis means knowledge. It's the foundation of the modern word knowledge, of course, Gnosis, which is why we've got a silent K at the beginning of knowledge. Yeah, the same as the silent G at the beginning of Gnosticism. Gnosis in Greek terms was translated into Latin as scientia, and scientia is science.
Yeah.
So the original religion was science, and I'm fully in favor of having a religion based on science. I would love that. So, you know, this Dan Brown idea that CERN was the center of a religion, you know, competing against the Vatican in his great book, which was that one?
It was Angels and Demons, I believe.
That's the one, Angels and Demons, is perfectly correct, because CERN is the center of science, which was the alternate religion instead of Christianity, which Saul set up. So under Gnosis or Scientia or science, you were not just allowed to investigate the universe. That was your primary reason for being here. You know, God had made this wonderful universe and this wonderful planet, And as a being of God, your role was to find out how this was all put together. That's the basis of science, isn't it? And I'm fully in favor of having a religion of that nature. The only difference I would put between myself and the Gnostics is that I would go with Akhenaten, who appeared to realize that God was actually a humanoid character who looks like Akhenaten was trying to portray himself as, you know, with the thin jaw, the wide temple, the conical head, and the rather feeble, effeminate-looking body with no genitalia. The standard alien grey, if you watch any sci-fi movie today, it's the same character. Right. Well, it is. I mean, if you look at the alien grey and compare him with Akhenaten, that's how Akhenaten was portraying himself. And it is no coincidence. Bizarre. Well, yeah, but it is no coincidence that the modern alien is created in the same form as Akhenaten. That is not a coincidence.
Well, what do you think that means? Is the attempt at a recreation of the same old religion, or why?
Yeah, because they knew what the gods looked like. This is what the gods looked like. So Akhenaten and the modern sci-fi are trying to portray what the gods look like, unless the god looked like a grey, basically. a little humanoid figure, not too dissimilar to humanoids, but with slight differences, exactly the same as Akhenaten was trying to portray. So, yes, we come back to the ancient astronaut theory. So the basis of Egyptian religion, the basis of, therefore, Judaic religion, was based on the idea of the ancient astronaut. And that's what Akhenaten was trying to reproduce. And we've sort of lost that, courtesy of Josephus, because Josephus knew nothing about this whatsoever, unfortunately. Josephus took us off on a 1,500-year detour, basically. If it wasn't for Josephus, you know, we could have had a man on the moon in AD 350. Well, we could, you know. They had all the basis of the technology was there during the Roman first century. And if we hadn't have had this diversion away from Gnosis, away from science, by Josephus Flavius, Saul as he was, we could have built on that. We could have had the first aircraft flying in, say, AD 300, maybe even AD 250. Let's call it AD 220, the first aircraft flying. Between the Wright brothers and the Apollo missions was 50 years, yeah? That's all it took, 50 years. So Wright brothers was like 1910, wasn't it? Something of that
nature?
Something
like that, yeah.
Apollo started in the 1960s and finished in 1968, didn't it? They landed in 68 or 69. 69, I think it was. So, you know, we're talking 60 years, call it, between Wright brothers and the Apollo landings. So if they had managed to fly the first aircraft in AD 220, they'd have been landing on the moon in AD 280. We could have done that. We could have done that if it wasn't for Josephus. And he just took us on this grand detour, 1,500-year grand detour away from science, away from Gnosis, taking us back to the Dark Ages, when research was banned, investigations were banned, alternative thinking was banned. And it set us back, you know, as a civilization by 1,500 years. So I hope these so-called historians who are against alternative thinking just realize what they're playing with here, that their stifling of other ideas is exactly what Saul Josephus did. And it was the biggest calamity that modern civilization has ever known. So let's hope we don't go through that again, because, you know, certain people, certain religions who are gaining more and more power in the modern world, take us back to those same old ideas where alternative thinking was just simply not allowed. I mean, you look at the problems we have with modern Islam, where Islam will not contemplate any thinking that's outside the limits of the Quran, basically. You know, I've had so many discussions with about Islam out in the East, out in the heartlands of the Muslim world, and they will not think outside the box. They will not think outside the Quran. Even modern scientists, modern professionals within the East, you ask them a question about science, and the first thing they'll say is, well, in the Quran it says, oh my goodness, forget the Quran. You cannot run a 24/7 technological civilization working on the back of the Quran. It just does not work. Yeah. And that's why, of course, we see the East as being the series of failed states that they are, because it stifles independent thought in the same way that Saul Josephus did. So we stand at a bit of a crossroads here, you know, at the 21st century. Are we going to go backwards or forwards? You know, when I was brought up in the 60s, I was brought up in the Apollo era. I lived with that. I was 10-ish. I remember I was still in junior school when they landed on the moon, and we all sat there around the only television we had, which was in the school, and we all watched the Apollo landings. And it was obvious that we would have a base on the moon by about, you know, 1978. We would be on Mars by 1990. Oh, it was guaranteed. It was guaranteed.
Yeah.
And where have we gone? And where have we gone? We allow ourselves to slip backwards at our peril, because our entire civilization depends on the technology and the advances we have made. We cannot go back to an agrarian economy and feed 7 billion people. It just does not work, you know. A dark age economy will feed 200 million people on the whole earth. So we go backwards at our peril, and unfortunately, with the attitude of these people I've been coming across, both within academia and especially within Islam, we have to be careful, because we may lose everything that we had, just like the Romans lost everything they had. The Romans probably thought their civilization would last forever.
Sure, yeah.
It was so powerful. They had all the technology. Everything was working just wonderfully. They had the most marvelous cities, probably better cities than we have today, with all modern convenience of fresh running water, all the sewage systems, all the massive great temples, everything working just perfectly. And then they lost it. And it all went to rack and ruin. And all their marvelous temples and all their marvelous amphitheaters. Their amphitheaters, I can't believe what I saw for the Dark Age amphitheater, where they turned the amphitheater into a town and filled it full of ramshackle old huts and houses. And they lived inside the amphitheater. That's how far they regressed in the Dark Ages. You know, you could not have fun, entertainment, all these wonderful things that humanity should have, and they did have within the Roman Empire, and they lost it. And we could do exactly the same in the 21st century, you know.
Oh, sure.
We can go one way or the other, and it's, unfortunately, it's our choice, and we have to make these hard choices, and someone has to make that hard choice, which way we're going to go. So yes, that's my thought for today.
Well, that's, no, I mean, absolutely, it's things to think about, Ralph. I think you know, your point as well, that science also have now turned into a new religion, is also very pertinent. And indeed, I mean, yes. I think that basic honest investigation and letting the answers lead us where they may, that is a must if we are to, you know, progress in any regard, and be able to bloom again in some way as a civilization. And again, I just find it so interesting. We look back into the past, and although we only have remnants of what once was going on, it seems like things were way more in order, if you will, harmonious. It was a connection to the natural systems in a completely different way, and we're just so disconnected from all of that right now. And many of us are living in a fantasy world, to be honest. You know, so
yes, they are indeed. Yeah. So yes, it's an interesting story. We look backwards and we look forwards as well, because that's the whole point of historical research. We cannot determine the future. We cannot plan the future unless you know the past. And that's why we need to know more accurately what actually happened, you know, all these years ago. Because it does affect us. It does affect us in the modern world.
Well, otherwise we make the wrong decisions if we have the wrong information, you know, about where to go next. So yeah, you're right. Well, this has been really good to have you back again, Ralph. We always appreciate it, hearing about your work and your thoughts and your opinion surrounding everything that goes on that's connected to it. Why don't we again then leave for this time with you giving out your websites, and if there's any other links or something like that you want to point to if it comes to some of the discussions you've had out there.
Yes. Well, the main website I have is www.edfu-books.com. The books cover everything from the Old Testament to the New Testament. In fact, actually, I've got two books on the pyramids as well. Have we ever discussed the books on the pyramids?
I don't think we have.
For the future. We'll have to do that. I've got two books on the pyramids. And they're interesting because they're very different as well. And then this latest one, all New Testament. So this is the King Jesus trilogy. It starts with Cleopatra to Christ and then King Jesus. And then the final one, which was just out a few months ago, which is Jesus, King of Edessa. And that almost wraps it up. But of course, these things are never fully wrapped up. So there's bound to be something else coming up in the future.
For sure. Oh, well, for sure. There always is. Well, we'll keep going. Huh?
Yes, on the discussions, there were a fairly good discussion. I'm just trying to see what the name of the people discussing this was.
And we can link that up too, by the way, if you...
Yeah,
if
we can do that later anyway. There's a few discussions going on the web. My Facebook site has always got some information on it pointing towards these things. And so actually has my website. I think it's got some news up pointing towards these particular discussions. So readers can have a quick look at that.
All right, very good. Yeah.
Yes. So very good to be with you again, Henrik. It's... always a pleasure to be on Red Ice, and more power to your elbow, because as I've said many times before, we get more feedback off Red Ice than anything else I do. So we do appreciate your activities.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much, Ralph. We thank you for your time. And again, edfu-books.com is the website. Go on over there, check it out. Pick up a copy of the Lives book if you want to read more and find out more about where Ralph's investigation has gone this time. So thanks again, Ralph.
Thank you.
All right, and that's that. Thank you for listening and for subscribing to RedEyesMembers.com. Much more to come with Troy McLaughlin and Theodore A. Holden on their book Cosmos in Collision. Ole Damogård, Harry Hubbard, Graham Hancock, and Penny Pierce are further ahead. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth, and of course, to you as well for listening. We couldn't do this without you, so we do appreciate it. Take good care, and we'll talk to you soon.